Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the NOAA Monthly Climate Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. If you have a question, press one and then zero. If you should require assistance on today's call, please press star and then zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host, John Bateman. Please go ahead.
Thanks so much, Lisa, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining the monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, the media, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. If you have additional questions after the conclusion of today's call, my colleague, John Leslie, and I can both be reached by email at, and I will spell it, nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. That is nesdis.pa, as in public affairs, at noaa.gov. Today's update will feature three short presentations, followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. And a copy of the presentation our speakers will be following can be downloaded from the link in the online media advisory. With that, I will introduce our speakers. Our first presenter is Karen Gleason, Monitoring Section Chief at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the October 2024 U.S. and Global Climate Report, as well as the latest drought monitor update. Our second presenter is Mark Svoboda, Director of the National Drought Mitigation Center at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, who will review the extensive dryness and drought that covered much of the contiguous U.S. in October. And our last presenter will be Matt Rosenkranz with NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Niño-La Niña update, as well as the U.S. seasonal outlooks for temperature, precipitation, and drought for December, January, and February. With that, we will kick off this media briefing with Karen from NOAA NCEI.
Thank you, John, and thanks to everyone for joining the call today. I want to begin by thanking everyone for their patience over the last 8 weeks while NCEI worked to recover from the impacts following Hurricane Helene to NCEI's headquarters in Asheville, North Carolina, and the surrounding communities. NCEI was able to release its September reports in late October and recently released the October reports on schedule in early November. Our online products and tools are now being updated on a regular basis and are operational once again. And with that, let's begin our presentation on slide number two, looking at the global temperature data for October 2024. On slide two, we see that the global surface temperature anomaly was Fahrenheit above the 20th century average, making this the second warmest October on record and 0.05 of a degree Celsius cooler than what we saw back in October of 2023. Global land-only temperatures for October ranked warmest on record at 2.18 degrees Celsius above average. Ocean-only temperatures ranked second warmest on record for October at 0.94 degrees Celsius above average. Looking at the temperature departure map on the left and the corresponding percentile in the map on the right, we see above average temperatures that are denoted by shades of red and below average temperatures shades of blue. Record warm October temperatures covered much of the Arctic as well as portions of the southwestern U.S. and northern Mexico. Record warmth also impacted parts of India and Pakistan, as well as pockets across Africa and South America. Areas with cooler than average temperatures included the southern half of Greenland, parts of western Canada and eastern Alaska, central and southern Africa, central and northern Asia, parts of southwest Asia, and areas of eastern Antarctica. Over the global oceans, record warm temperatures were most notable in the Caribbean, parts of the eastern Indian Ocean, the northwestern Pacific, and parts of the Southern Ocean. widespread areas of near average to below average sea surface temperatures occurred in the eastern equatorial Pacific, the southeastern Pacific, the Gulf of Alaska, the Bering Sea, and small portions of the southern Indian Ocean. During October, approximately 15.5% of the world's ocean surface had a record high temperature, exceeding the previous October record set in 2015 by nearly 6.5%. Looking at continental temperature rankings for October, North America ranked warmest, with South America and Oceania ranking second warmest, Europe was fourth warmest, Asia fifth warmest, and Africa 10th warmest. Shifting our attention now to slide number 3, we see the January through October 2024 global temperature percentiles map, the year-to-date temperature anomaly plots for the 10 warmest years on record, as well as the annual temperature rankings outlook for the year. The January to October global surface temperature ranked warmest in the 175-year record at 1.28 degrees Celsius or 2.30 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term average, exceeding last year's year-to-date value by 0.14 of a degree Celsius. Record warm temperatures were observed across large portions of Central America and Northern South America, the Northeast U.S. and Southeastern Canada, large portions of Africa, as well as Southern and Eastern Europe, much of China, South Korea, and Japan, and Southeast Asia. Small regions of land areas with near average to below average year-to-date temperatures occurred in portions of southeastern Greenland and Iceland, parts of southwestern Alaska, the southern tip of South America, and the Russian Far East. In a pattern similar to recent year-to-date periods, the first 10 months of the year had record warm sea surface temperatures covering most of the tropical and subtropical Atlantic, most of the northern half of the Indian Ocean, the western equatorial Pacific, and parts of the northwestern Pacific, and small areas on the southern Atlantic, southern Pacific, and southern Indian Oceans. By contrast, areas where oceans were near to below average for this period include the southeastern Pacific, the southwestern Atlantic, extending to western parts of the southern ocean, southwestern Indian Ocean, and an area in the North Atlantic. Looking at the time series plot on the right-hand side of the slide for the year-to-date temperature anomalies for the 10 warmest years on record, we see that January through October 2024, the anomaly value, as depicted by the black bar on the graph, has been consistently above the year-to-date anomaly values for the 10 warmest years on record and is indeed the warmest January through October period on record, with 2023 coming in second place for January through October and 2016 rounding out the top three at this point in the calendar year. And according to NCEI's annual temperature ranking outlook statistical analysis, as depicted by the bar plot on the bottom of the slide, there is a greater than 99% chance that 2024 will end as the warmest year on record, exceeding the record warmth observed just last year. Moving on to slide number 4, looking a little closer to home at the contiguous U.S., we see that October temperatures averaged 59 degrees Fahrenheit, which was nearly 5 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term mean. This translates to a ranking of second warmest in the last 130 years. Looking at the temperature rank map on the left, we see that in general, temperatures were above average to record warm across all of the lower 48 states, with record warm October temperatures across the states of Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. Precipitation for the month averaged 0.95 inches, which was 1.21 inches below the long-term mean, which was second driest on record for this month. Looking at the precipitation map on the right, we can see that precipitation was below average across much of the U.S., with near average conditions concentrated in portions of the West, and above average precipitation across Florida. New Jersey and Delaware ranked driest on record, while 19 additional states from Texas to the Northeast had one of their 10 driest Octobers on record. Looking now at slide number 5, we see the temperature and precipitation ranks for the January to October year-to-date period across the contiguous U.S., temperatures averaged 58.3 degrees Fahrenheit, which was 3.3 degrees Fahrenheit above average. This was also second warmest for this 10-month period. Looking at the temperature rank maps on the left, we see that nearly the entire lower 48 had either much above average or record warm temperatures for this 10-month period. New Mexico, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, West Virginia, Virginia, Pennsylvania, New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine each ranked warmest on record, with an additional 35 states ranking among their 10 warmest such year-to-date periods on record. Precipitation for this year-to-date period averaged 26.17 inches, which was 0.83 inches above average, which translates to an above average ranking or in the top third of the historical distribution. Drier than average conditions were present across portions of the Northwest, Northern Rockies and Plains, Southwest, Central Plains, and Ohio Valley. Conversely, precipitation was above average across parts of the Upper Midwest, Great Lakes, the Northeast, and from the Mid-Atlantic to Florida and across parts of the Central Gulf Coast. Looking now at the latest confirmed billion-dollar weather and climate disasters on slide number 6, no new billion-dollar disasters were confirmed in November, although three new events, including Hurricanes Debby, Helene, and Milton, were added in late October when the September report was issued. For the year to date, there have been 24 confirmed events identified through October, which is second only to the 27 events identified through October of last year. These 24 disasters identified during 2024 consist of 17 severe storm events, 4 tropical cyclone events, 1 wildfire event, and 2 winter storms. Looking now at slide number 7 and the latest U.S. drought monitor map released just this morning, we see that approximately 45.5% of the contiguous U.S. is currently in drought. This is up about 14% when compared with early October. Drought conditions contracted or became less severe across parts of the Pacific Northwest and the Central Plains. Drought conditions expanded or intensified across large portions of the Northeast and specifically along the eastern seaboard, parts of the Great Lakes, the Northern Rockies and Plains, the Southeast, the Deep South, and the Southwest. Outside of the contiguous U.S., drought coverage expanded and intensified across the Hawaiian Islands. And with that, I'll turn the presentation over to Mark to talk more about this expansion of drought across the country.
Thank you, Karen. Yeah, so let's do a little deeper dive into drought. I thought I would start with sort of where are we now with the rest of the presentation focused on October. But you can see for the 3 weeks since the last part of October, this sort of dry pattern has continued along the eastern seaboard and into parts of the southeast and the Gulf Coast. Which is going to play off, as you'll see in the coming maps, how dry October was. So we have seen some really good rains in sort of the heartland central part of the United States, though, that was very much needed. And that pattern has continued as well. So good to see that. So that's slide 8. Let's go to slide 9. This really, by a lot of definitions, fits what we call a flash drought, where the map on the left was the beginning of October. I think even without seeing statistics, you can see the map on the right really shows how drought has expanded very rapidly over that four-week period ending October 29th. And in fact, we saw a 22.5% increase in drought, D1, almost 20% in D2, which is severe drought, and then just shy of 4% in extreme drought D3, and even a slight increase in the worst drought category, D4, or exceptional drought. So these two maps show very quickly how things have expanded. That's playing off continued dryness. You're going to see some impact information I provide later on in the winter wheat belt. You can see that dryness extending all the way from the border with Montana and Canada, all the way down to the Rio Grande part of Texas, and then remnant dryness that we've seen a pretty strong drought this year in sort of the Ohio, West Virginia, headwaters region for that, which is, again, sort of another cause for why we've seen low water levels in the Mississippi River, for example. So let's go to slide 10. Some more specific numbers. This actually shows the change in drought monitor classified categories from D0 to D4. You can see across most of the country between October 1st and October 29th, 1 to 2 category changes, in some cases in parts of Texas, Missouri, 3 class degradation in the drought monitor just over that 4-week period. So that's a really textbook definition of a rapidly intensifying drought. But what's unique is how widespread this is. I mean, this is virtually no part of the country saw much in the way of improvement according to the drought monitor for that month, and dryness really dominates the landscape. So, you know, we had 87% of the U.S. in abnormally dry or drought conditions by the end of October. We saw, for example, the greatest one-week increase in history of the USDM, so the 9th greatest one-week increase of all drought categories. And that's across over 1,300 weeks now. We've been doing this back to 1999. That's a pretty significant number. For D2 to D4, which again is severe drought to exceptional drought, we've seen the second greatest one-week increase at the end of October of over 7.5%. So those aren't trivial numbers. That's moving the needle quite a bit. When you're looking at national numbers like this, when you zoom into some of the regions, it becomes even more impressive. And we'll touch on some of the dryness that has been dominating the news across the eastern U.S. in particular. It just goes to show that drought is not just a Western phenomenon. This is having a lot of impacts on fires and water supply along the East Coast as well. Moving to slide 11. Here we see, for some broader context, to sort of look at how I'm going to set up the impact information at the end of this presentation. Slide 11 shows 4 to 5 class degradation across the northern high plains, sort of in that area that I talked about earlier with West Virginia, Ohio, and parts of southwestern Pennsylvania, and then the Atlantic seaboard there from North Carolina up into New England. So these are pretty pronounced changes. Again, that's for the period of January 2nd through last week's map, and that trend wouldn't have changed a whole lot if you looked at this week's trend map. So a lot of people go to the website at droughtmonitor.unl.edu, which is at the bottom of this map. That's the official repository for all the drought monitor services and maps. You'll find a lot behind the curtain besides this week's current map. I would encourage you to go look at the map archives. There's a lot of cool tools in there to compare certain weeks, to look at these change maps that I'm showing you here, that gives a little bit more detail than just what's on the current map each week. So take a look at that, and if you have any questions, please feel free to follow up. Okay, slide 12. Kind of repeating, I won't dwell on this too much because Karen covered this nicely, but just to reinforce, we saw this combination, sort of a double whammy of both warmth and dryness, right? And not just a little bit of warmth and a little bit of dryness. In many cases, this is very warm or very dry, and in some cases, both, depending on the location, like in parts of Texas. Luckily, if the temperatures have been worse in October across the eastern seaboard, we'd be in even worse shape. And in fact, I'll show on the next slide, you know, the hurricanes had a role in sort of the up and down nature of too much, too little. But, you know, for example, record dryness in Newark, Philadelphia, Wilmington, Allentown, Atlantic City, Bridgeport, all along that eastern seaboard, that dark brown splotch there centered on eastern Pennsylvania, New Jersey, parts of New York, really, really dry, in fact, record dry with either no precip, a trace, or maybe 1/100th of an inch at most. So very, very dry. and the temperatures in the west and in the southern plains, we've had a lot of fire issues there driven by the increased temperatures in those regions. Okay, if we move to slide 13, I was talking a little bit earlier about the effects of Hurricanes Francine, Helene, and Milton. That really kept things from being much, much worse, and in fact, they're still pretty bad. When you look at October, things flipped back over to the dry side. Only Milton hitting Florida probably kept that number on the wet side, or they'd be a little drier than they are. But certainly looking at those ranks from the southeast, Mississippi, all the way up into New England, along the coast there, reinforces how that drought was re-entrenching itself. And this is normally a dry time of year there. So if you're not going to get tropical storms or hurricanes, this would be the time where oftentimes you do see it. But a lot of these places were already coming off a dry late summer, early fall as well. So that's why the Northeast lights up a little drier. And you see those record numbers we were talking about earlier. So if we go back to August through October, which is the map on the right, there you see the impact of some of that moisture coming off the Atlantic or Gulf Coast that's kept those numbers a little bit more at bay seasonally. Even though October went dry, it's a double-edged sword. You know, you don't wish for the destruction and certainly not the flooding that we saw with some of these events, but they are make-or-break drought makers and drought breakers, whether you have these storms or not in this region, especially at this time of year as we wind down the tropical storm season. All right, let me wrap up with just slide 14, which is to give you a few sound bites of ideas of where we are seeing impacts. And I focused a lot on the east, and not to forget, we've had still some dryness reemerging in the west, although now we've got atmospheric rivers to think about going forward, and we're seeing a big one happening real soon here. But Santa Ana winds and the dryness, the intense heat in the west I talked about has really led to fires, which have been in the headlines for a couple years now in the west, particularly in California. But it's also been a real big issue in the northeast. So that, yes, it's a drier time of year, you do see fires, but widespread, intense fires, this is becoming a bigger and bigger story in the northeast due to that drought and those temperatures. I mentioned earlier winter wheat's really taken a beating, especially as this is the key point in time where it's been planted and it's emerging, that they want that moisture to give it strength going through the winter to protect the roots from winter kill. And that moisture's been lacking across a good chunk of the wheat belt. Most of that rain's been centered just to the east of it, and then that's been more recent just in sort of the central plain. So that's worth keeping an eye on as we go forward. The dryness, on the other hand, was really great for harvest, for corn and soybeans and things like that. So it's, again, sort of a double-edged sword. This dryness has also led to a lack of forage in this region for livestock, cattle in particular. That's led to a lot of early culling or reduction of herd, which is leading to increased prices of beef in the grocery stores. So you're probably noticing that already. That's an issue going forward into next year as well, as you just don't flip a switch and bring those numbers right back up immediately. There's always a little bit of a lag to that, and drought plays a role on that due to reducing forage in a region, and then they have to try to bring it in from somewhere else, and that costs more money. So droughts have a role there. The other big story has sort of been, if you look at the drainage basins of the Great Lakes in general, and that was shown in some of the earlier maps by Karen and myself, that's led to a drawdown of the lake levels, particularly Lake Superior, which has really dropped, in fact, the lowest it's been since a decade now, in 2014. And so that combination of dryness and heat leads to greater evaporation off that lake surface, and that's why those numbers are dropping across most of the Great Lakes. And I touched on the Mississippi River earlier, and that's another direct impact of the headwaters for both the upper Mississippi as well as the Ohio that feed into the Mississippi Basin have definitely led to year three of very low levels, which affects barge traffic, big industry, and saltwater intrusion quite a ways up the Mississippi River begins to affect urban centers as well. So these are all things you may not, might be considered more indirect impacts, but certainly the effects of drought are being felt. And then finally, touching on a lot of those northeastern U.S. impacts, record lows, you've seen a lot of drought watches, warnings, and even emergencies, including the Washington, D.C. and New York City areas as a result of this continued dryness. And with that, if you go to slide 15, that's my contact information. And at this point, I'm going to turn it back over to Matt. Thanks.
Hello, everybody. This is Matt Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. So on slide 16, we're going to start talking about what the latest state of El Nino is, La Nina, or ENSO as it's collectively referred to, the El Nino Southern Oscillation. The look at the map on the left. It generally shows that the sea surface temperatures in the equatorial Pacific are near to below normal, although those temperatures are closer to normal than they were 1 month ago. The current Nino 3.4 value, which is the metric that NOAA uses to measure El Nino status, is exactly at zero when it was down at about minus 0.4 or minus 0.5 a couple weeks ago. So we have seen some kind of warming of the Nino region recently, and that's likely related to things that happened in October, sub-seasonal variability moving through there, things that kind of change the month to month. And we are expecting a return to kind of a downward trend in the Nino 3.4 temperature, which would give us that higher chances of going into a La Nina as we get into the winter. By the time we get to the end of December, we are have a 57% chance of being in a La Nina condition by then, with a 72% chance of, actually 73% chance, excuse me, of being in La Nina during November, December, January. And then about a 70% chance of being in La Nina during December, January, February, the first season for which our outlooks were just released on our website a few minutes ago. We do expect La Nina to kind of hold on through the winter and into the early part of the Northern Hemisphere spring. February, March, April is where we're expecting that transition to happen. So then by March, April, May, we should be towards an what we call an ENSO neutral, which is no strong signal kind of either way for the state of La Nina and El Nino. How does that impact the forecast? Slide 17 is our first glimpse into that, where we get into the forecast for December. So the monthly forecast for December has generally more favoring above normal temperatures across the southern tier of the U.S., California, Nevada, and then eastward to the Carolinas and southward to the Gulf Coast. There is currently, and to the north of that, there is equal chances, which really says your best forecast is to use climatology. So therefore, and that's really related to the fact that we're going to likely to start off November, or excuse me, December, quite cold across the northern plains. But then there are some sub-seasonal factors that are likely to make it quite a bit warmer across the northern plains in the middle of December with a potential return to cold at the end. So you kind of have a lot of variability there. And when you average that out across the month, there's very weak signals across the northern tier of the CONUS during December. We have a little bit more certainty in some of that cold hanging around in southern Alaska due to the fact that that's related to potential La Nina impacts. And with Alaska kind of being further to the west and closer to the source of variability for La Nina in the Pacific, your signals there are a little bit more certain. How that plays out in the precipitation is outlook for December is that we are expecting also dry conditions along the southern tier of the U.S. So potentially continuing some of the conditions that Mark mentioned, where it's both warm and dry across some of the southern tier of the U.S., some of that is likely to continue into December. There could be some reprieve across the northwestern U.S., where we do favor above normal precipitation, and that can be related to the La Nina and also the subseasonal variability that could push warmth across the northern plains can also bring some storm track activity into the Pacific Northwest. La Nina would also favor a background where you'd have more wet conditions into western Alaska, as the storm track can sometimes be kind of focused on the western parts of Alaska, so including the Aleutians and the west coast of Alaska. You can end up with a lot of storminess moving into there during La Nina conditions, and we are expecting to see those conditions kind of really start to emerge in that December period. And slide 18, how does that, those conditions go for December, January, February? We're expecting to see kind of continued above normal temperatures across the southern tier of the U.S., although we are expecting, we are favoring above normal temperatures to also expand northward into the northeast U.S., potentially with a storm track in the Ohio Valley. And that would bring warm air on the east of the storm track and kind of cool air on the west of the storm track. So therefore, we're also favoring below normal temperatures across much of the northern plains. Those below normal temperatures are likely to extend all the way to the Pacific Northwest, and that is related to the development of La Nina. Also, there are trends, long-term trends, 15, 20-year trends, that do also show the some kind of, in the wintertime, higher odds for near to below normal temperatures across the northern plains and some parts of the northern Rockies. So those two factors really go into that outlook. For December, January, February precipitation, we are favoring above normal precipitation from the Pacific Northwest to across Montana and Wyoming to the kind of western parts of kind of the high plains, the northern high plains. And then also another area of above normal precipitation around the Great Lakes extending down into the Ohio Valley. Aligned with the monthly map for December, the December, January, February outlook does favor below normal precipitation across the southern tier of the U.S., especially the Rio Grande Valley, Four Corners region, and then also across Florida. I will note that our probabilities this month for December, January, February are slightly increased for above normal precipitation in the kind of northern Rockies, but they are kind of moderated compared to some of our prior outlooks related to La Nina across the southern tier, Rio Grande Valley in the southeast, because there is only a 57% chance of being in La Nina during October, November, December, and then the 70% chance of being in it during December, January, February. So we're not, it's not certain that we'll be in La Nina, so we have some of these odds are a bit moderated compared to where we might be this point of the year if we were in a much stronger La Nina case as we had forecast earlier in the year. So slide 19 kind of talks about, shows the drought outlook for valid through the end of February 2025. And we are, and kind of integrating the impacts of those outlooks, so we are expecting some drought improvement and removal in the Pacific Northwest across the Northern Rockies, kind of consistent with the above normal precipitation favored there. And then there's also some removal and improvement likely in the Ohio Valley down to the Tennessee River Valley, and also up to the Corn Belt and Western Great Lakes. So some of those areas that Mark talked about before that have been kind of hampered and impacted by drought may get some relief. On the other side of that, though, we are likely to see some drought expansion and or intensification on parts of much of the southeast where the La Nina storm track would not favor more precipitation, neither in the southeast or in the kind of southern plains or in the Four Corners region. So you may continue to see water deficit problems from Arizona to Texas, across to Alabama, and then potentially up the east coast where drought is at least forecast to persist from Virginia all the way up until Maine due to the overall storm track likely being shifted inland as associated with La Nina's. So that's all I have, and I will turn it back to John.
All right. Thanks so much, Matt. We will now take specific questions from the call participants. Please be sure to identify who you'd like to answer the question if possible. And Lisa, could you please remind the call participants how they can ask a question, and then please queue up the first question.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please press 1 and then 0 on your telephone keypad. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you do have a question, press 1 and then 0 at this time. And we do have a question from Brian Sullivan with Bloomberg News. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I just have a quick question. I know drought can have an effect on temperature in the summertime, but I was wondering, is there any kind of corresponding effect on temperatures in the wintertime from widespread areas of drought?
This is Matt Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. Yes, when you look at correlations between soil moisture or lack of there and drought, it can lead to higher temperatures in the summertime. Those correlations do tend to fade off in the autumn. Early autumn, you can get dry signals leading to much higher temperature swings, so your colder nights but also warmer days at the same time, and then that averages out to not too much different in the autumn. By the time you get to winter, you don't notice much of a direct impact on soil moisture affecting temperature. Northern plains, you can end up with more snow cover having a much bigger impact on that. But there's very little signature for soil moisture or lack thereof reflected in drought having a relation to temperature in the winter season.
Thank you.
This is Mark. I'll just quickly add to that. I think the bigger issue for me when I'm looking at drought and overwintering, so to speak, and especially if you don't have soil moisture recharge, is the susceptibility of being, what's your situation going into planting next spring. The other thing that good soil moisture would do versus not having it in the case of drought over the winter is the sort of insulating effect that it has on everything from your local garden, trees, shrubs, to agricultural fields. And as I mentioned, winter wheat, the potential for winter kill is going to be greater. That dry soil is not going to protect those roots. So, nothing to do with sort of the temperature element that Matt was talking about, but from an impact standpoint, you can still see some impacts, even though that's typically for the eastern half of the United States, a drier sort of period of time. Thanks.
Thank you. As a reminder, press 1 and then 0 for questions. Once again, 1 and then 0 for questions. And we have no further questions at this time. Please continue.
All right. Thanks, Lisa. If there are no further questions, I will wrap up the call. First, I'd like to thank all of our speakers for their time and everyone else for participating in the conference call today. I will end by reminding you to mark your calendar for a few upcoming events. The release of the November 2024 U.S. Climate Report is scheduled for December 9th. The release of the November 2024 Global Climate Report is scheduled for December 12th. And our next monthly media climate call will be held at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on December 19th. A media advisory will be issued and posted online ahead of that event. And lastly, an audio file of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov media advisory site later this afternoon. And if you have any further informational needs, please feel free to email me, John Bateman. My contact information is available at the top of the media advisory. Thank you.
Thank you. That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T Executive Teleconference. You may now disconnect.